Well, I didn't ask you what you didn't want to be, son. I asked what you want to be. Well, I imagine by a process of elimination, we could eventually cover every possible occupation and whichever one he didn't mention. Oh, I guess that's what he wants to be. But in fact, when we think about how we present the gospel to people, it seems to me an awful lot of preaching that's been done in the past has been not so much to tell people what the gospel is as to what it is not. Or to present people what the church of Jesus Christ is not as opposed to what it is. And we need to recognize that it is important to tell some people some things about the truth that are not. There are some things about Christianity that are not. There are things about God's church that are not. But there are an awful lot of things that are important about what we are as God's people. And without that balance to our preaching, then we're simply going to come across as naysayers. Oh, we don't do this and we don't do that. Tell me about your church. Well, we don't do this and we don't do that. Well, we're not telling them a thing about the church, really. We're just telling them about a lot of things we're not. But what are we? And that's what we want to look at this morning as we consider this question of what we are versus what we are not. Turn, if you will, to Mark chapter 11. We're going to resume our study in the Gospel of Mark this morning, picking up now in verse 12. And we realize with the triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem that this last week of Jesus' life has begun. And these are the last moments of Jesus' teaching upon this earth. And he has a lot of very pointed information, accusation, indictment against the very people who are going to wind up putting him to death before the week is over. Well, let's notice the first interesting story we run across here is the story of the cursing of the fig tree. So in chapter 11, verse 12, on the next day when he had left Bethany, he became hungry. And seeing at a distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves. Because it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples were listening. Now in true Hollywood video form here, we're going to have a cut of the scene to something else for a while before we come back to the fig tree. And so they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those that were buying and selling in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves, and he would not permit anyone to carry stuff through the temple. And he began to teach and say to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations'? But you've made it a robber's den." The chief priests and the scribes heard this and began seeking how to destroy him, for they were afraid of him. For the whole crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, he would go out of the city. And as they were passing by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots up. And being reminded, Peter said to him, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered." And Jesus answered, saying to them, "Have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, 'Be taken up and cast into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says is going to happen, it will be granted him. And therefore I say to you, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them, and they will be granted you. Whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father who is in heaven will also forgive you your transgressions." And then you'll notice verse 26 is in some manuscripts, not in others, and some English Bibles include it and some don't. But it says the same thing Matthew chapter 6, verse 15 says, so it's certainly a biblical principle, whether it was originally part of Mark chapter 11 or not. If you do not forgive, neither will your Father who is in heaven forgive your transgressions. Well, what does this have to do with what we are versus what we are not? Well, you think about the lesson of the fig tree, the basic point of the story ought to be pretty obvious to us, that these people are unfruitful. Now, there's no question that the fig tree really represents the nation of Israel. The fig tree and the vine are often used throughout the Old Testament as a symbol of God's covenant with Israel and God's promise that He had made to the people. Part of that central promise was that God would provide them a land that they would dwell in, and every man would stand under his own fig tree and his own vine. And that indicated the prosperity and the blessing that God would give His people. And if we understand then that this is really a parable in action, that it's not just, oh, Jesus got mad at a certain fig tree and just zapped it, and oh, that, no, look, the fig tree's dead, and that's all there is to it. And so, you know, the biblical writer puts it in here. That's not what's happening. You know, Jesus did a lot of things. You know, one day He walks by a dandelion, but we're not told that because it doesn't have any particular significance. But the reason this is recorded is because it has some teaching for us if we would understand the lesson. God has His people. They are to be fruitful. And yet they're not producing the fruit that God intends. And therefore, God will curse Israel. In fact, the ultimate rejection, the ultimate fruitlessness of the nation Israel is going to be seen this very week, in which they will reject Jesus as the Messiah and put Him to death. How much more unfruitful can you get? And yet you notice part of the story of the fig tree is that Jesus goes to the fig tree looking for something to eat. But then we are told in verse 13, it's not the time for figs. So why in the world would Jesus go looking for figs when there shouldn't be any figs anyway? That just doesn't seem fair. Would you like me to come over to your house and you've just planted a tomato plant, hoping in time you're going to grow some tomatoes, and I just come over to that little seedling and I just rip it out of the ground. I say, oh, this rotten tomato plant hasn't produced any tomatoes yet. Well, Tom, I just planted it. It's not going to produce anything for a few weeks yet. Well, I don't care. It's not producing tomatoes yet. The problem is that this fig tree gave the appearance of being ahead of its time. It was putting out its leaves. It wasn't the season for doing that yet either. The problem is it gives the appearance of being a precocious fig tree. It gives the hope that there could be some figs here to eat. And so Jesus, seeing that, goes over to look at the fig tree and finds out there aren't any figs. And so it gives the appearance of being a productive, green, vibrant, fruitful fig tree, but in fact it isn't. And that even more so is the character of Israel. Israel stands out among the nations as being God's people, those that receive the oracles of God, the special promises of God, His covenant relationship with them. It had given them every kind of advantage, and here they were as this vibrant, spiritual people representing themselves to the world as being alive with God's Spirit. But the reality is they're not producing the fruit God's looking for. And so they represent themselves being one thing, but in fact they're really something else. And so therefore the curse of God falls upon this lying fig tree, this hypocritical fig tree, and the lesson is that just as surely Israel is going to receive the judgment of God upon them because of their hypocrisy, giving the appearance of being spiritual, but in fact not being. Now we read the story, and of course the lesson for us isn't a historical one. Oh, let's all sit and ponder here what happened 2,000 years ago to the nation Israel that Jesus came to and was rejected by. The application for us is pretty obvious. Here we are assembling on a Sunday morning, representing ourselves to be a congregation of people that belong to Jesus Christ. How do I know that? Because the sign says so. We are a church of Christ. We are representing ourselves as being spiritually alive, productive and fruitful in the Lord's cause, doing what the Lord wants us to do. But if the Lord were to come and inspect us, would He find the kind of fruit that we ought to be growing? Would He find figs? Could you imagine the Lord coming and He's saying, well, no watermelons, no lemons, No apricots. You shouldn't be finding those things in a fig tree anyway. You come looking for figs in a fig tree, and you wouldn't expect to find all that other stuff. That goes without saying. And yet so often we spend so much of our time preaching saying, we don't make watermelons. We don't make lemons. But what do we make? Well, we ought to be making figs. And if we're a barren and unproductive fig tree, and we're not making watermelons and lemons and everything else, well, so what? The real question is, are we making figs or not? If we're not making any figs, what difference does it make if we're not making all that other stuff? And are we really not making all of the other stuff because we're not watermelon vines or lemon trees or something else, or is it simply because we're being unproductive and unfruitful? And so the point is, we're supposed to be a fig tree. And fig trees, by definition, are not producing a lot of other things that have nothing to do with figs, but they are supposed to be producing figs. That's the whole purpose for being a fig tree. And what is our whole purpose of being God's people but to produce the fruit of the Spirit and to be doing the things that God has called us to do? And yes, we can note from time to time, you know, someone comes along and says, you know what you people ought to be doing is making watermelons. And we should say to them, no, we're fig trees. We're not supposed to be making watermelons. There is a proper place for telling people what we don't do, but that is no substitute for not doing what we ought to be doing. And that's the main lesson we need to get out of this story. Are we doing what God's told us to do? And when the Lord returns, He's not going to give us heaps of credit for all the things we did not do as much as did we do what we were supposed to do. Now, the lesson that occurs in between the cursing of the fig tree and the result of that, the withering of the fig tree, is another story that illustrates this very point about just how corrupt and bad Israel has gotten. So he goes to the temple. And what place in all of the nation of Israel represents the spiritual life of Israel? If anything's happening in Israel, it ought to be in the temple. And he goes there and he finds people making, you know, a living, buying and selling of merchandise. And you think about the rationale for that. It isn't like they just set up, you know, a flea market in the temple just to make money. They are providing a valuable service. People want to make sacrifices. Well, it's kind of hard if you're traveling all the way from Turkey to come down to Jerusalem to observe the Passover, you know, to pack your sheep in, your luggage, and carry it with you to Jerusalem. Well, buy one when you get there. You know, acquire the sacrifices right there, be pretty convenient. Well, nothing wrong with that. But, what was happening, Jesus says, is you're corrupting God's temple. No longer is it a house of prayer for all the nations, but rather it's become a den for thieves. Now, the one passage is a quotation from Isaiah 56, which is another one of those marvelous passages that any right-thinking Jew who read his Bible must have scratched his head and said, what in the world does this mean? How is God's temple, which just by definition to them excludes the Gentiles from participating in it, how is it going to become a house of prayer for all the Gentiles, for all the nations? And it's yet just another one of many passages that speak of the inclusion of the Gentiles in God's purpose. The other passage, the reference to the den of thieves, refers to a passage back in Jeremiah chapter 7. And this is where it becomes very telling of what's going on here, because we realize there's an extent to which one can say, these people buying and selling, they're ripping people off. And that's a kind of theft. More importantly, they're stealing from the people spiritually. But the worst part of it all is seen in the figure itself. A den of thieves is not a place that thieves go to steal. A den is where thieves go to hide out. And so in Jeremiah chapter 7, where Jeremiah was making that great temple speech, he was saying, you people think you can go out here and commit murder and adultery and lie and everything else, and then you're going to come and stand before God in this place and say, oh, the temple of the Lord, Oh, how we love Yahweh. You know, it's like playing a game with God, and this is our safe base, that we can escape the wrath of God. If we just kill enough cows, that'll keep God off our back. And so you go out and live as you please, but quickly run back to the temple. That's going to be your hideout. That's going to be your safe location, your refuge from the life that you have lived. You again see the hypocrisy of that, and yet religious people today can fall prey to the same notion. If we think by going to church on Sunday is going to somehow compensate and make up for living lives that are displeasing God Monday through Saturday, we are woefully deceived. And it is not enough, again, to look at all the things that we're not doing, but what are we doing? And is what we are doing pleasant to the Lord? Is it what the Lord wants us to do or not? Now, one other side lesson in all of this story of the fig tree is, you know, Peter, he's amazed. And he said, well, look, this fig tree that you cursed, it's already withered. The consequence of Jesus' judgment on the fig tree was pretty instantaneous. And Jesus' lesson to them about this is, trust in God. Whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, and doesn't doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says is going to happen, it will happen. Well, that's pretty astounding. Does that mean then that anything I pray for, that if I just believe strong enough, it's going to happen without any qualification whatsoever? No. The Bible doesn't teach us that. And there are many places in the Bible that teach us there are certain qualifications of prayer. Again, verse 26 is one of those. I don't care how much you believe in what you ask of God that He's going to give it to you. If you're not forgiving of other people, He's not going to forgive you. That's just one of many qualifications that God puts on prayer. But the ultimate qualification on prayer is that if your trust is really in God and not yourself, then no Christian ever prays, God, you give me this, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I've made a demand of you. I demand that you bring back my loved one from the dead, and you're going to do it. That's not trusting in God. The attitude of prayer is manifest by Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, Father, take this cup from me. But my real prayer is, your will be done. And if that's not your will, then I don't want it to be done. Now, I ask for this, God, because in my feeble wisdom, this is what I think is best. But God, I want you to do what's best. That's always our prayer, and we should have the confidence that God will always do what is best for us. God will always answer that prayer, yes. But the specific things we might requisition of God, we can't make those as demands of God and understand, oh, I've just got carte blanche to ask God for whatever I want, and He's got to give it to me. No, it's about trusting in God. That's the point of the story. Many have debated this issue. Well, if I just asked a mountain to be cast into the sea. I can't think of this anymore to think about the Japanese. You know, they took four mountains and put them in the sea to build that airport on, and it's still sinking, you know, in the ocean. You know, man is capable of doing that. You know, it might take a while, and a wheelbarrow full at a time and so on before you can get that mountain done. But I really don't think that's the main point of what Jesus is getting at. You notice He says, say to this mountain, be cast into the sea. Why does He say this mountain? Why not just say to a mountain? Pick any mountain you want, Mount Everest. You know, certainly in the context of what Jesus is saying, the very mountain He's standing on is Mount Zion. And that's where the temple is built, up on top of this mountain. And I think what He's really getting at is connected here with this same judgment that's coming against the nation Israel. Their job as the apostles, as they go out and begin preaching the gospel, will be to cast Judaism into the sea, so to speak. That all of that represents, that old system of things, is going to be cast down by their very preaching. That's going to be the power of the gospel. And the other side of that, that really still applies to us today, is, you notice how Jesus says, when you stand praying, forgive If you have anything against anyone, so your Father who is in heaven will also forgive you your transgressions. You know, we spend so much time worrying about some literal mountain somewhere that I might pray can just shift itself and be planted in the sea in some material fashion. That's not really the main point. What purpose do I have in moving material mountains? The mountains in my life I have to worry about, the ones that really give me trouble, are most of all sin. And that's the real question. What is your attitude about sin? And if you think it's easier to move sin and cast it aside than it is to move a physical mountain, you've got the wrong attitude about sin. If I were to say to you, you can pray to God and your sin be removed. That's great. Wonderful. You can pray to God and Mount Everest will get up and hop over into the Pacific Ocean. Wow! You're kidding! Oh, wow, that'd be really something! I'd like to see that! We'd get all excited about that, wouldn't we? But sin, that's no big deal. Well, sin is the biggest mountain you're ever going to see. And it is so deeply rooted and it is immobile. And the only thing that can move it is the grace of God and our trusting in God. And when we pray that God will forgive us, that's the ultimate mountain that needs to be cast aside out of our life. And that's really what Jesus is getting at. So don't read the story and look at it as some kind of absolute statement about prayer that anything you ask for, that's what's going to happen. But in the context of what the Bible teaches us about our relationship with God, that ultimately it is about our trust in Him. But let's keep our focus on what the real problem is. What is my relationship with God and what will hinder that relationship and so on. So I don't want to be unfruitful like these people of God were. And one of the worst ways I can become unfruitful is by transforming even my religion, my prayer, into the very kind of thing that they had. We've got a temple. We pray. That makes us God's people. That makes us spiritual and alive. And any time your religion itself is transformed into something that makes God obligated to you, that you've got God all pinned in a box, then you've become just like these people. And so the lesson for us is just the opposite. Don't presume on God. Don't think at any point that you make some demand of God, but you trust in God. And that's what these people were failing to do. They had substituted the rituals that they performed, the acts that they went through, the fact that they were descendants of Abraham, the fact that they had this temple, and they put their trust in all of those things rather than simply trusting in God. And if we put our trust in God, we will be fruitful. If we put our trust in anything else, we will be unfruitful. And that's the ultimate lesson to all of that. Now there's a second lesson as we continue reading in the Gospel of Mark, and we now skip ahead to chapter 12, and we get a very similar figure, another parable about now a vineyard. Instead of a fig tree, we now turn to the vine. Now, we mention how often the vine and the fig tree are linked together throughout the Old Testament. So we got a fig tree, now we got our vine. And so he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard, put a wall around it, dug a vat under the wine press, built a tower. And that's clearly at a reference back to Isaiah chapter 11, where the imagery of the planting of this choice vine by God as Israel's represented and so on, that's rooted in that passage. And he rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. At the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard from the vine growers. And they took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And again, he sent them another slave, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully, and he sent another, and that one they killed, and so with many others, beating some and killing others. Now, again, this is a parable, and I'd start thinking, man, how many people I don't have to send before I wise up that they're just going to keep killing them off? But you realize, of course, this represents God. And it's not that God's been sending people and he's shocked that they're being mistreated. It is, again, out of his compassion and love that he keeps appealing to the people to repent. And clearly these agents that God has sent represent the prophets who've been mistreated, even been put to death. But he had one more to send, a beloved son, and sent him last of all to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But those vine growers said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." And they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. And what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the vine growers and will give the vineyard to others. Have you not even read this scripture? The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And here's a quotation from Psalm 118, which you'll recall links us back to the earlier part of chapter 11. "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord," that is quoted in connection with the triumphal entry of Jesus. And so Jesus is going to be rejected. Again, we see in the parable, God sends his son. But they kill him and cast him out. Now, what's going to happen? God's going to judge these people. Now, not only are they being unfruitful, but now we realize they are rebellious. They are disobedient. They are unwilling to allow themselves to be governed by God. They are unmanageable, in addition to being unfruitful. And it is this rebellion, this disobedience that they commit that also brings them under God's judgment. Well, the lesson for us again is similar to the one from the fig tree. When you link these two together, when we are being unfruitful, it isn't simply that we're being barren, that we're not getting the job done. That unfruitfulness itself is rebellion against God and disobedience to God. It's not as if God has asked something of us that is impossible, something that is so difficult. What He asks of us is simple trust in Him, to love Him, and desire to please Him. And that means doing the things that He wants us to do and not doing those things He doesn't want us to do. And the spiritual leadership, particularly of the people, had been left to tend God's people, God's vineyard for Him, but they did a sorry job of it and even reject the vineyard owner's son who comes to collect what is rightfully his. And God has sent Jesus to us. And He has a right to demand of us what is His, what belongs to Him. We're reminded, even in terms of our physical bodies, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, you're not your own, you were bought with a price. Glorify God, therefore, even in your body. Our whole life belongs to God. Everything is His. And so we're simply stewards. And how are we conducting ourselves as stewards of God's precious possessions and giving to Him what is rightfully His? And when we refuse to do that, we refuse to be productive and fruitful for the Lord's cause, we are in rebellion and disobedience to Him. And we bring ourselves under God's judgment under both of these scenarios, under both of these parables that we're taught. And I think the key that links both of these stories is found in the story that's in between, which ultimately we must conclude that these people were unteachable. And it is the story of the questioning of what authority Jesus did the things that He did. And you can see from their perspective here, this Yehu comes out of the sticks, and the people have treated Him as if He's the Messiah. And He comes into the temple and He just turns everything upside down. What gives you the right to do this? You know, by what authority do you do this? You know, by what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority to do these things? In verse 28, "And Jesus said to them, 'I will ask you one question, and you answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? Answer me.' And they began reasoning among themselves, saying, 'Well, if we say from heaven, He'll say, why did you not believe Him? And if we say from men,' well," they were afraid of the people, "for everyone considered John to have been a real prophet. And answering Jesus, they said, 'We don't know.' And Jesus said to them, 'Nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things.'" Now, of course, they weren't being honest. They weren't taking responsibility to try to find out and to decide for themselves whether John was a true prophet or not. And incidentally, on what basis could they have decided that question? John didn't work any signs, apparently. None are recorded in the Bible. In fact, the popular opinion of people is recorded, well, John did no signs, but you know, certainly everything he has said about this man has come true in reference to Jesus. And so it wasn't on the basis of his miracle working they were going to be able to decide, oh, he's a true prophet, but rather on his teaching. And comparing his teaching with what had been previously revealed throughout the Old Testament, is it consistent? Were his calls for repentance genuine? Would they resonate with the people? Should they have resonated with the people? Of course, the Bible has to understand, yes, and most surely. But that's the challenge. These are, again, not supposedly just stupid people, just randomly picked off the street, you know. These are the religious authorities. It's their job to know who are true prophets. It would be their job to know if there's a false prophet among them and to deal with it. But they're revealed to be the corrupt political types that they are by their plotting, well, if we say from heaven, well, why didn't we listen to him? Why didn't we submit to it? But if we go against the popular opinion, well, and what will the people think of us? So they claim not to know. And this puts Jesus in an easy position because either they're incompetent and can't know, in which case what right do they have to know the truth? What are they going to do with it? They had the truth of John staring them in the face and they couldn't handle it. They couldn't decide from that whether it was of heaven or of men. And so if they're just that stupid, they're just too stupid to understand the answer if Jesus were to give it to them. But worse, if they really do know the answer, but they are dishonest about it, and they reject the authority, then it really doesn't matter what Jesus says. Whatever answer he gives, they're not going to accept it. They're only going to hear what they want to hear. They got their minds made up. And therefore, again, they are really unteachable. Once again, we can look at that ancient generation of Jesus' day and say, oh yeah, what a mess of people they were. But we need to understand whether we're going to be fruitful for the Lord or not, whether we are going to be governable by God or not, depends upon our answer to this question, by what authority did Jesus do what he did? It all gets back to this very root question of authority. Is God who he claims to be? Does God have the right to tell me what he wants? Is God the one that's in charge? Now, we all here pay lip service to answering those questions. Oh, yeah, there is a God, and he's in charge, and he's revealed what he wants in the Bible. But once again, that's not the real question in our daily life. The real question practically for us is, do we really believe that? Or again, do we find ourselves, well, we come on Sunday and we go through the motions of pretending to be Christians and saying the right things and singing the right songs. But when Monday comes, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And the gospel really has no impact on that. It doesn't really change who I am, what decisions I make, what kind of husband I am, what kind of father I am, what kind of mother, wife. You know, I'm going to do my typical routine throughout the week. But then I'm going to come back on Sunday and I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do something special because I'm a Christian. Now, if we're following Christ, we're following Christ Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. We're doing what Christ wants. And that will make us trust in Him. It'll make us fruitful in Him. It'll make us submit to Him in all things. Have you ever found yourself sitting in a congregation of people and you feel like, you know, I'm just not very motivated to do X, Y, or Z? Well, no one else is doing it, so I guess I don't need to worry about it. Or, well, why do I need to be doing that? No one else is. And what we're really saying is that my service to the Lord is somehow dependent upon what other people are willing to do or not willing to do. What does that have to do with it? If Christ wants me to do this, then I need to do it. And it doesn't matter whether anyone joins me in that or not. I'm going to do it because I'm following Christ. I'm not following the church. I'm not here to do what the church tells me to do. I'm here to follow Christ, and I'm here to do what Christ tells me to do. All of these people of the generation of the Jews of this week of Jesus' life, they were all pretty similar to one another. They were all kind of going along with the flow. The people could look to their authorities, their spiritual leadership, and say, oh, well, that's what they're doing. I guess that's okay. That didn't make it right. And in the same way, we need to determine what the Lord wants us to do and to be fruitful in obeying Him and submitting to that authority. And so it always comes back to that question of authority again, time and time again. And that brings me back to where we started. I've heard so often people talk about the glory days of preaching the gospel. You know, back in the 40s and the 50s, the gospel was preached and so many people were obeying the gospel. How wonderful that was. Well, it's great to preach the gospel and have large numbers of people responding to the gospel. But the question is, how do you know that was what was happening? Now, all man can see is the external consequences that's going on. Only God can judge the heart. But I can tell you certainly the one thing that came out of all of that, and that was all the mess that we had of the divisions of the later 50s and the 60s. And so whatever kind of preaching was going on in the 40s and the 50s wasn't the kind of preaching that was building God's people to be the kind of people to resist the kind of nonsense we got in the later 50s and the 60s. Were those the glory days of the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ? Or maybe we were preaching a gospel in such a way that it was unbalanced, and we were preaching a lot about, oh, well, we're not that kind of group and we don't do those things. But maybe there wasn't enough preaching about what we are. Yeah, I think in connection with the greatest generation, you know, we've labeled this group that went through the Depression and World War II. And again, extraordinary character of people to go through that. But that's the same generation that gave us the kids of the 50s and the 60s. And it's probably the reason we got the kids of the 50s and the 60s was because their parents had gone through such adversity and didn't want their precious darlings to go through the same things that they did. Didn't it occur to anyone that it was the adversity of the Depression and the adversity of war that created that character? And if so, then the depriving of those things to their children would result in the opposite. And so, yeah, they were the greatest generation about some things, but they were the most worthless generation when it came to parenting their children. Again, it's a matter ultimately of balance. We can't just pick some things and say, we're doing a great job about not doing these things. And a lot of that preaching that was done in those old days was, these denominations over here, they're doing this and this and this and this. We don't do those things. And our identity was carved out by being the denomination that doesn't do all these other things these other denominations are doing. And we just converted people to denominationalism and sectarianism of a different stripe. Well, that's not good enough. It's not what are we not. It's what are we as well as what are we or not. And if we're going to be truly God's people, then what are the marks of a New Testament congregation of God's people? And you've seen tracts like I have, marks of the church. And, you know, here's the kind of elders they ought to have, and here's how they ought to conduct their worship assemblies, and ought to have, you know, these numbers of acts of worship and so on. But is that the whole picture? And I've never seen a tract talking about the marks of a church of Jesus Christ that talked about compassion and forbearance and kindness and humility. And those are also part of the picture, clearly. If we're going to preach the gospel, it's got to be the whole counsel. It's got to be everything. And so, yeah, what we're not, we don't do these things. These things don't have the authority of God behind them. These things are displeasing to God. But also, these are the things that are pleasing to God. And these are the things that are consistent with God's character. And all of it must be taught, and all of it must go together. Otherwise, we will be unfruitful. We may give the appearance of being spiritually alive, but in fact, we're not producing the kind of character, the kind of Christians that God is looking for, that imitate the very character and being of Christ. And we'll bring ourselves under God's judgment just as surely. What difference does it make if we're not doing this over here? But we're also not being what God wants us to be. We'll still be under God's judgment. And so what are we to be? What are we trying to be? And that's a question each one of us needs to answer individually, certainly. It's also a question that we need to answer as a group of people. A congregation of believers, of Christians, of people who want to serve God and do what's right, and do what the Bible says. Nothing more, nothing less, nothing else. But to follow what God says and please Him in all things. But that means all things. Not just picking and choosing certain things. And so we try to please Him in all things. And that's a big challenge. And yet we're here to encourage one another in doing just that. If you will take your songbook out and turn to number 356. And here is the image of Christ calling to us to follow Him. And that's our appeal to you this morning. But it has to be the true picture of Christ. The Christ that is portrayed in the Bible. Not a Christ of our own imagination, not a Christ of our own creation, but the Christ who makes the demands of us that He does and calls us ultimately to love Him and trust in Him, to humble ourselves to Him, and everything else flows out of that. And if we can help you in evaluating the needs that you have this morning and how you need to respond to that and making yourself a true follower of Jesus Christ, we're here to help you and encourage you in doing just that. If there's some way we can help you this morning, let us know while we stand and sing the song of encouragement.